You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You're listening to This Week in Palestine, and I'm your host, Ann Lucas. On the day I am recording this, I received a package at my door that I did not recognize or expect. When I opened it, I remembered. It was the new memorial edition of the book, Gaza Writes Back, Short Stories from Young Writers in Gaza, Palestine. The book was edited by Refaat El-Arir back in 2014, and featured writers who were his students at the time. I pre-ordered it on December 6th, the anniversary of Refaat's murder in Gaza at the hands of the Israelis. Just World Publishers re-released the book in December of 2024 to honor Refaat's life and legacy a year after his murder. It occurs to me as I'm saying this that though I never knew Refaat in life, I still call him by his first name, as if he was a close friend. And in some ways, he is a close friend. I often read while lying on my bed, and anyone whose words have been with me in my bed is by definition very close to me. But that was also just who Refaat was. He had a very friendly demeanor in life, and he was very approachable. And he was a teacher in the true sense of the word. He met us all where we were at, with humility. As part of the new release, Just World Publishers held an event featuring writers from the original 2014 publication. In this show, I will be sharing five speakers, colleagues and students of Refaat, storytellers in their own right, reflecting on Refaat through their own stories about him. These different writers take very different approaches to remembering and honoring their teacher, but you can feel Refaat's influence and voice in each of them. A reminder that Refaat lives in the hearts and minds of so many. He will never be forgotten. He will never stop being part of Palestine. This was both very emotional for me to listen to, but also very cathartic, and I hope you find it to be very cathartic too. We truly have a lot to listen to. So yalla bina, let's go. Just a few notes before we start. We will first hear from Ali Abu Nima, reading passages of the foreword he contributed to the new edition of Gaza Writes Back. He is, of course, one of the co-founders of Electric Intifada, where he publishes, among other places. Then we will hear from four student contributors to Gaza Writes Back: Yusuf Al-Jamal, Rowan Yagri, Sarah Ali, and Mohammed Soliman. First, we will be hearing from Ali Abu Nima, reading passages of the foreword he contributed to the new edition of Gaza Writes Back. Ali is a ubiquitous journalist and, of course, the co-founder of Electric Intifada. Then we will hear from four student contributors to Gaza Writes Back: Yusuf Al-Jamal, Rowan Yagri, Sarah Ali, and Mohammed Soliman. Yosef cannot make the event live, so his contribution is recorded. All the other presentations were done live. After Ali Abu Nima, each one of the writers will be introduced as the event goes on. And with that, here is Gaza Writes Back, 2024.
What we know is that on December 6, 2023, Refaat was at home, at the home of his sister Asma in the Al Sidra neighborhood of Gaza City. At about 6 p.m., Israeli forces fired a missile at the building, killing Refaat, his brother Salah, and one of Salah's sons, and Asma and three of her children. Refaat, the father of six children, was just 44 years old. The airstrike surgically targeted the apartment on the second floor, not the whole building, a clear indication that the apartment, and almost certainly Refaat himself, was the intended target. His killing was part of Israel's systematic and targeted extermination of Gaza's leading intellectuals, academics, and scientists, a hallmark of genocide. By late January 2024, Israel had murdered at least 94 university professors, along with hundreds of teachers and thousands of students. It had destroyed every university in Gaza and damaged or destroyed hundreds of schools. The scale of the genocide in Gaza reverberates through this book, even though it was first published more than a decade earlier. This new edition contains short about the writer's essays from 9 of the original storytellers, but the publishers were unable to contact the other story contributors in time to get their updated self-descriptions into this edition, and the fate of several of them remains unknown. A friend of Rifat told the Euromed Human Rights Monitor that days before he was murdered, Rifat had received an anonymous call from someone who identified himself as an Israeli officer. The caller warned Rifat that they knew precisely which school he was sheltering in and that advancing Israeli ground forces would soon reach his location. That call prompted Rifat to move to his sister's apartment, likely thinking it was less conspicuous than the overcrowded school where his continued presence could endanger many more people if Israel sought to kill him. This was Rifat. He always put others first. Just a few weeks earlier, Rifat and his family had been sheltering at the Arantisi Children's Hospital in Gaza City. They fled there after Israel bombed their apartment building in Tel El Hawa, but the hospital would not provide safety for long. On November 10, my daughter Shema woke me up and showed me a video of the Israeli tanks right below our window, Rifat recalled in his last article for the Electronic Intifada. It was terrifying. The tank was huge. As Israeli forces gathered to attack and occupy the hospital, which they would do the following day, claiming falsely that Israeli captives were held there by Hamas, Rifat understood the urgency of leaving. He gathered about 2 dozen people together, mostly children. "Listen," he said, "I do not want anyone to cry and scream. I will be blunt." He laid out the frightening scenario the group could face from the Israeli soldiers as they tried to leave the besieged hospital. They might let the women and children go and shoot the young men. That point elicited a number of screams, Rifat wrote, but he was firm. "If that is the case, and I want to be clear, do not look back," he instructed. "No matter what happens to us, do not scream or cry. Keep going east, keep running." Terrifying though it was, they survived that day, and as Rifat observed, the fact that Israel allowed everyone to leave proved that its claims of Hamas activities at the hospital were lies. No one was detained or even questioned. Rifat's friend, Asim al-Nabi, a member of the Gaza City Municipality's Emergency Committee, was one of the last people to see him alive. Over the last days and weeks, he and I would walk every day. He always looked everywhere for inspiration. He looked at everything, Asim recalled after Rifat's murder. Anyone who knew Rifat knows that he was a very solid man, steadfast in unimaginable ways, Asim said. But the day before he was killed, Rifat surprised Asim by admitting how exhausted he was. "I'm tired of carrying water. I'm tired. I am responsible for 50 people," Asim recalled Rifat saying. Rifat continued to walk around his beloved Gaza City with Asim, searching for eSIM cards or a mobile phone signal. You would find him climbing on top of high walls, lifting his arm up to get reception, putting himself in danger just to convey a message. Though he was tired, Rifat never stopped caring for others. When he walked down the streets, he would advise random people, telling them where to go, where to be safe, Asim said. The last thing Rifat told him, according to Asim, was that if God kept him alive, he would want to focus all his life to tell the stories of his people and their experiences and feelings. The truth is that Rifat had already devoted his life to this mission, as this book, first published in 2014, attests. In his editor's introduction, Rifat explains, far more eloquently than I can, the power of stories to break mental and physical bonds, to reshape perceptions, and thus to be a tool to create a new, more just world. When I reread it today, it is as fresh, poignant, and relevant as on the day Rifat wrote it. And throughout the genocide until his murder, Rifat never stopped doing the work he loved. Despite the desperate struggle to find water, food, and safety, he would message me whenever he could, forwarding drafts of articles written by his students scattered across a burning Gaza. He would help, encourage, and sometimes admonish them to write stories, poems, and testimonies and send them to us at the Electronic Intifada to share with the world. And we did. All those pieces you published for my students keep me going, he wrote me less than a month into the genocide. Rifat's dedication to Gaza and its people reflected his own deep love for a place long abandoned by the world. He believed in Gaza. Following his graduate studies in the UK and earning a PhD in Malaysia, Rifat, who could have gone anywhere, went back to Gaza, determined to serve his community. He became a professor of English literature at the Islamic University of Gaza, the institution where he had done his undergraduate studies. He had chosen to major in English literature, and as an educator, he imparted his love for poetry and the plays of Shakespeare to generations of students. The proud son of a laborer and the second of 14 children, Rifat was a child of Shuja'iyah, the Gaza city district whose name means Land of the Brave. Like so many Palestinians, Rifat's earliest memories were marred by Israeli violence. While he was a child, his father and mother were nearly killed on separate occasions by Israeli bullets and shells. He himself was shot by Israeli soldiers with rubber-coated steel bullets, and on one occasion, an Israeli soldier threw a rock at him from the roof of a building, injuring him. And even before the genocide, Rifat and his wife Nusayba had between them lost dozens of relatives to Israel's decades of occupation and persecution of the Palestinian people. During its onslaught against Gaza in the summer of 2014, Israel bombed the home of Nusayba's sister, killing her and her husband and several of the couple's children. This horrifying toll, Rifat wrote in a May 2021 op-ed for the New York Times, made them a perfectly average Palestinian couple. The first piece Rifat ever wrote for the Electronic Intifada in 2014 told the story of his martyred brother, Muhammad Hamada, who is beloved by children across Gaza, Palestine, and the Arab world for his TV character Karkur, a mischievous chicken he played on TV. Israel destroyed Rifat's home during the 2014 war, a building that housed dozens of members of his extended family. Asim recalls accompanying his friend to the ruins, where Rifat went straight to the room where he kept all his students' poems and stories. They were all burned and scattered on the floor, and he would pick through the rubble to salvage what he could as if he was gathering treasure, Asim remembered. To him, these stories and poems were the most precious memories of his beloved students. When Rifat's building was destroyed by Israel in October 2023, he lamented in a text message to me the loss of the thousands of books I collected over 30 years. The books can be replaced, Rifat. You cannot, I responded. You have at least another 30 years ahead of you to collect books, maybe 50 years. He barely had another 30 days. And thanks to Israel, Rifat's losses would not end after his death. On April 26, 2024, Israel murdered Rifat's beloved daughter, Shayma, along with her husband, Muhammad Abdul Aziz Siam, and their infant son, Abdul Rahman, in what appeared to be another deliberately targeted surgical strike. Shortly after Abdul Rahman was born, Shayma had posted a message on social media addressed to her deceased father. I have beautiful news for you, and I wish I could tell you while you were in front of me, handing you your first grandchild. Did you know that you have become a grandfather? Shayma wrote. I just want to end with a few more sentences. I treasure the memories of the times I spent with Rifat in Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Chicago, and California when he came to the United States in 2014 with contributors Yusuf al-Jamal and Rawan Yaghi, to promote Gaza rights back. I feel his absence acutely, but with each passing day, I appreciate ever more the impact he had on me and on the world. When Rifat's beloved brother Hamada was killed in 2014, Rifat wrote, "Israel's barbarity to murder people in Gaza and to sever the connections between people and people, and between people and land, and between people and memories. I lost my brother physically, but the connection with him will remain forever and ever," Rifat added. "He taught us that stories are what bind us together and keep our hope alive." Rifat, too, is still with us through his own words and the words of the many young Palestinians he continues to inspire to write their own stories and the stories of their people. I'm so happy to see you again, Rawan. This is the first time I see you since 2014. And Sarah, you were supposed to be with us in 2014, and I'm happy you're with us now, but I wish it was a different occasion. Let me just now introduce who had the honor of working closely with Rifat. They were very dear, close friends. The love they had for each other was just beautiful to see when they were together. And in the last year, Yusuf has been working closely with Rifat's family in order to protect and extend Rifat's legacy. And also, a very important thing to note, that this week, too, OR Books has released a wide-ranging anthology of Rifat's writings in poetry and prose, which I have here. It's called If I Must Die, and it's available from the OR Books website, just as the book we're celebrating today, the memorial edition of Gaza Rights Back, is available from the Just World Books website. And Yusuf edited Rifat's book, If I Must Die, the anthology, and it has a beautiful foreword by the Palestinian writer Susan Abulhawa. As Helena mentioned, Yusuf sends his regrets that he can't be here in person, but I'm happy to say that both Helena and Yusuf will be with us live on the next Electronic Intifada live stream, which will be on December 11th, to talk more about Rifat and his work. But now we can go to the video that Yusuf has sent for today's event.
My name is Yusuf al-Jamal, and I am a student of Rifat Larayir. Over the years, we became close friends. We traveled together. We lived together. And I would say it's the honor of my life that I got to see Rifat and learn from him. He was a friend, a mentor, a teacher, a father, a grandfather, yet he did not live long enough to see his grandchild, who was killed along with his father and Rifat's daughter, Shayma, in an Israeli airstrike in April this year. Is a remarkable person, a global person, I would say, who believed in resistance. Even when he taught classes supported by USAID, he would advocate for resistance and teach students in Gaza about Malcolm X and the need to say no. He would always quote Malcolm X as saying, "Early in life, I learned that if you want to get something, you have to make some noise." And Rifat's noise came through storytelling. He nurtured in thousands of students the love for storytelling. He trained an army of bloggers and writers from Gaza, young people. He gave them dozens of lectures, training, workshops, so that they could write their stories. He made every student to believe that they can tell their story, and most importantly, that they have a story that deserves to be told. Rifat was the funniest person on earth. He had the greatest sense of dark humor. And that's why we love to be around him. We'd always enjoy his jokes, his wisdom, and the way he would connect politics with philosophy, with translation, with literature. He was very smart, and students liked to be around him. And we never felt that there is a barrier between us students. and Rifat, the teacher. It always felt that we had a big brother who guided us and gave us the needed time to grow. Rifat was busy. I would always imagine Rifat walking around with a book or a novel under his elbow, probably going to give another lecture, another webinar. But he always made sure that every student of his had enough time or feedback so that they could become a better version of themselves. I want to share a story I had with Rifat to just let you know how funny he was. So one time I had dinner at a friend's house after staying with Rifat for 3 weeks. He took care of me and I liked the dinner. It was great. But when I posted that the dinner was great and that I finally had a good dinner, Rifat got upset and called me and he said, "I've been feeding you for 3 weeks and you never said thank you." I said, "Sorry, I didn't mean to make you feel bad. I just wanted to share the idea that the dinner I had was good." And said, I will not accept this apology. Like, you have to come and we have to discuss this issue in detail." So I went to his place and he said, "The only way I would forgive you is if you go and buy us a watermelon." So I went downstairs and I bought Rifat and his flatmates a watermelon. And that was our reconciliation agreement. And of course, we sat and we ate the watermelon and we had more stories from Rifat and more fun. He would always like sit and talk and tell stories. It feels like I have spent time with my grandma because of the stories he would tell. And he had so many stories and would always speak about the impact his mother and his grandmother had on him because of the storytelling tradition that they passed to him, which he passed to his children. This is how the idea of Gaza Rice Bag came to life. For Rifat, he thought that his students who endured Israeli occupation, siege, and especially caste-led operation would find in storytelling and narrative a way to heal. So he asked his students to write stories after they endured a caste-led operation 2008, 2000, and he worked on these stories and he published them in Gaza Rice Back. And he was very glad to publish Gaza Rice Back. It felt like his baby. He told me that the first time he had this book published, that was his book published ever, it felt like having a baby for the first time. So the Gaza Rice Back is Rifat's baby. And he would be very proud to talk about it and the translations, different translations of the book. And I was recently told by his son, Ahmed, that he had a copy with him when he was assassinated, a copy of Gaza Rice Back. I remember during the Gaza Rice Back speaking tour, Rifat would always repeat that he chose fiction because fiction is universal and it speaks to people regardless of their race and background or time. It could be read 100 years later versus like news or like factual stories that are limited to a specific time period. So he wanted to be global in his narrative and in his book. And I think these stories will be read about Gaza for years to come. And that's, again, the wisdom of Rifat. He was always ahead of his time. He was a visionary person. And I remember when there was this article about him being visionary in one of the reviews, he kept joking about it and saying, "Rifat Larir is visionary, rising above others." And of course, that's Rifat. That's our teacher. Thank you very much, Helena. And let's keep Rifat's legacy alive.
It's remarkable to me that whenever I hear Yusuf telling stories about Rifat, I feel like I'm hearing Rifat. Like nothing else makes me feel like I'm hearing Rifat than when Yusuf tells stories about him. And it was wonderful to hear that. Again, just a reminder to people that also coming out this week is this book by Rifat, edited by Yusuf, If I Must Die, from our books. And Yusuf will be talking about that more, I'm sure, in coming days. So I want to now introduce Rowan Yali again. She is, of course, a writer herself from Gaza. She is joining this session today from Canada. She's also the editor of a project called Rifat Writes Back, and she'll be telling us more about that too.
Thank you, Ali. I think because Rifat was obsessed with beginnings, I've struggled a lot with beginning anything about him. It feels like he's going to judge anything I say or write about him so harshly. But anyway, he began Gaza Writes Back with a poem about living, drawing a rocket with his words. And he began his talks in the U.S. with variations of Palestine as a story or Palestine is a story away, and the love Palestinians have for their land through story. And besides the great speaker that I was very fortunate to travel around the U.S. with, I knew Rifat, the friend and the brother. I remember being really stressed because I had exams 2 months after the book tour. And he would make jokes and pretend Italian and call Yusuf a diavolo, the only Italian word I could successfully teach him, to my greatest dismay. And then by our last talk, I was sick of both of them. I was sick of Yusuf and Rifat and their constant banter, half of which I didn't even understand. I was even like doodling sometimes on pieces of paper while they gave their talks. But when I read my stories, he was always like sitting next to me, smirking and watching people, even if I had read my story for the 30th time. So he loved stories so much that he would listen to them over and over again and repeat them over and over again and watch people listen to them over and over again, because he found something new to value and love every time. And it's that Rifat that I remember, and that comes with a lot of pain and despair that he, even after his passing, I think he didn't want us to linger on. It's like he was thinking of us, urging us to find hope and change and to not linger on the sadness of his death, but to take political action from it, to derive hope from change. And I think this is partly why I started Rifat Writes Back. It's a newsletter that features writers from Gaza and aims to support writers from Gaza. And today we published a beautiful tribute I don't know if I can post it in the chat, but I can ask people to move it around. At the beginning, a beautiful tribute by Iman Bashir, I must say, who's an amazing writer and a former student of Dr. Rifat and a close friend of his as well. At the beginning of the piece, she says that she hates the word legacy, and that it erases the personhood and the little things that made Rifat who he was, especially for the people around him. Her eloquent piece emphasizes how Rifat didn't just write and love stories, but he cultivated each relationship with the same love he had for stories. And this is why the U.S. tour was so important for him. He kept in close touch with almost everyone who hosted us. And he wanted to go back. It wasn't just an advocacy or a promotion trip for him. I was reading Isabella Hamad's lecture, Recognizing the Stranger. And by the way, Rifat's story uses recognition in many ways, and you should all read them. And he goes to such extremes as to suggest that recognition can be fatal. But anyway, Hamad talks about how turning points in history aren't seen as turning points while they're happening by the people they're happening to. And I think she said this back in January of this year. And it's been a year since Dr. Rafat was killed. For a lot of us, it's still not real and it still doesn't make sense, partly because of the context in which it's happened, a genocide that is still ongoing, and something that no matter how much we intellectualize, we will never make sense of. But Dr. Rafat's assassination feels like a turning point to a lot of us. Like Iman says in her eloquent piece, and as I see a lot with the writers that have already published under Rafat Writes Back, we carry his wisdom with us, but we forge his path and a new path for the story of Palestine. And like he said in his beginning, we live. I will end on that note and introduce Sara Ali, who is a writer from Gaza and who is a student, a PhD student at Cambridge University. Thank you.
Thanks, Rowan. I'm going to be reading in part. So I was asked to focus on my interactions with Rafat at IRG. For those in our audience who do not know, IRG is the Islamic University of Gaza. It was founded in 1978 and was the first higher education institution in the Gaza Strip. It is the largest university in Gaza with 11 faculties and about 18,000 students. It was repeatedly bombed by Israeli occupation forces in the 2008-2009 onslaught on Gaza, again in 2014. During the ongoing genocide, IRG was targeted and bombed at least four times. First in October 2023, between the 9th and the 11th of October, Israel bombed eight buildings at IRG's main site in Gaza City. Then in December 2023, only a couple of days after Rafat was killed, they bombed and completely destroyed the Faculty of Medicine in the Middle Area campus. Then again, in January 2024, there was massive destruction of IRG's branch in Khan Yunis in the south of the Gaza Strip. I mention all of this not only to highlight the scholasticide, the systematic destruction of higher education in Gaza, but also because IRG is a place that Rifat loved so, so dearly. Rifat studied for his BA in English language and literature at IRG and then taught at IRG for a total of 15 years between his master's in London and his PhD in Malaysia. And then after he got his PhD in Malaysia and settled in Gaza. Rifat was an educator with intellectual rigor and boundless talent. He taught me briefly at IRG and had to leave our cohort because he started his PhD that year in Malaysia. But he taught me extensively outside IRG. I prefer the word educator to lecturer because Rifat was able to reach out to students who did not have institutional access to education in Gaza, especially those with a talent for writing fiction, poetry, and creative nonfiction. In the course of his life, Rifat gave an enormous number of literary translation and creative writing courses outside IRG. These are courses that young students in Gaza attended for free and that Rifat dedicated a lot of his time and energy to organizing. These were held in centers all over Gaza, just educational centers, media centers, translation centers. He reached out to students who he did not teach at IRG and was able to organize a lot of sessions completely for free. I personally cannot think of a stage of my education or career since I was 15 when I first met Rifat that was not influenced by Rifat's wisdom, guidance, and incredible support. The English Language and Literature Forum, Eye on Palestine, was run by Rifat for about a decade before it was shut down in 2010. This is an online forum that Mohammed was on, that Rowan was on, a lot of our friends were on, really long before social media became popular. It was a resourceful and interactive forum that helped young Palestinians in Gaza connect with the outside world long before social media became popular. We wrote stories and discussed poetry and sought joy in learning the nuances of English grammar. Some of the pieces submitted onto the forum went on to inspire stories that later became part of Gaza Rights Back. In 2016, Rifat and I became colleagues and taught at IOG together for about 4 years, teaching English literature at the Faculty of Arts. These were years of thoughtful insights and endless joy. I worked closely with Rifat, got to know him better as a colleague, and we sometimes taught the same modules, comparative literature, romanticism, and Victorian literature. Of course, Rifat always also found a way, while teaching English literature, he was, even in metaphysical poetry classes, he always found a way to including Palestinian literature. There was no module as such that was Palestinian literature, but Rifat always had an element or like an assignment or a creative writing site to his classes that included or asked students to write stories about their experience being Palestinians in Gaza. There's an amazing side to having Rifat as a workmate. Apart from the sheer joy of his humor, the snack sharing, and the cheesy puns, of course, the worse the puns were, the better. Rifat was an incredibly generous friend and colleague, always sharing resources and recommending books. Nobody I know dissected a poem and then sewed it back together into a perfect whole like Rifat did. You could listen to him read poetry and explain poetry and breathe poetry for hours on end. Rifat's passion, his integrity at work, and his devotion to his students made my own experience of teaching a lot more worthwhile. We organized seminars together, wrote examinations, hosted speakers, redesigned departmental study plans, and worked on annual shows for the English department. Rifat's knowledge, his brilliant guidance, and his sharp intellect defied the Israeli-imposed intellectual blockade on Palestinian students in Gaza. He helped create an environment that nourished curious minds and encouraged budding talents to thrive. There's a story from IUG that I always like to tell, because it encapsulates Rifat, the teacher, the friend, the mentor, the comrade, in many ways. Rifat and I were teaching the same module. I think it was Victorian literature. In between classes, I was really upset. We had a break, and I was telling Rifat that 5 students came to class but did not have the novel we were reading at the time. I mentioned it in passing. I knew that the students could not afford the book, and I was going to sort it out. But within an hour, before I could even do anything about it, Rifat comes back to the office with 5 copies of the book that he had bought and just tells me to tell the students that the faculty had extra copies. Of course, at IUG, the faculties never bought books for the students and they had to buy them themselves. This is the type of teacher that Rifat was, a teacher of humility, generosity, and empathy. Rifat was an incredible academic, literary critic, and educator. He wrote his PhD on John Donne and was obsessed with teaching metaphysical poetry and Shakespeare's sonnets. He taught an entire generation of young Palestinians in Gaza and was an incredibly intelligent, hardworking scholar and intellectual. I cannot think of a single person my age in Gaza who studied English language, English literature, or translation who is not directly influenced and guided by Rifat's wisdom, by his writing and his teaching. After Rifat was murdered, Palestinian author and novelist Suzanne Abul Hawa quoted a popular slogan used following the murder of indigenous environmental activist Berta Caceres. Berta did not die, she multiplied. Suzanne Abul Hawa quoted this to say that Rifat did not die, that he will multiply. I want to repeat that although these brilliant Palestinian intellectuals and educators are not with us today, their legacy will indeed live on. They did not die. They will multiply. Thank you. I would like now to hand over to Muhammad, who is an early student of Rifat and is currently a lecturer of sociology and media at the University of South Australia. Over to you, Muhammad.
It's an honor to be here with everyone and to, just be part of to be part of Rifat's story, really. And to have at some point been part of Rifat's life. So just like everyone here, I was a student of Rifat. So I came to know Rifat in 2007. That was 1 year after Israel imposed its blockade on Gaza. when Hamas rose to power. So it was a very critical period of Gaza's history. We were just beginning to feel or experience a different kind of occupation, different kind of political oppression. So that's the year that I joined the Islamic University of Gaza. That's the year I graduated from high school. I had no idea what I was going to study. So after a brief stint during the first semester of the academic year of 2007, I did a little bit of medicine. I thought that was bad. I didn't want to continue. I did engineering. I thought that was also, you know, terrible. So I kept looking for programs to study. I needed to go to uni. I looked at the syllabus of the English language and literature program. I could not yet speak a word of English back then. And I looked at the words Elizabethan and Victorian, and I liked how they sounded. So I thought, let me have a go at this. So the second semester, I went to the Islamic University of Gaza. I walked into the classroom. I was already late for class, and there was this man standing in the classroom, and he looked at me in passing, and obviously he did not like the fact that I was a newcomer, a new student, and I was already late. So I sat in the front seat. I had the audacity to sit in the front row. And by then, as I sat down, he asked a question. He said, what is ideology? I knew what ideology was. I had a sense of what it meant, but I could not get myself to say it in English. I knew this was English, and that's my first English class. This is my first interaction in an English language class. So I put my hand up, and he said, go on. I said, it's a way of thinking. So he placed his left hand on my left shoulder, and without looking at me, he said, brilliant. And that was my first moment and my first interaction with Rifat. I thought to myself, I am brilliant. Okay. I went on to study this classroom. My classmates said to me, are you sure you want to do this class? This is your first time to study English. You should have done the first semester before coming into this particular subject. It was called Introduction to English Literature, and it was taught by Rifat. And I was like, why not? They said, this is Rifat. Do you even know who this man is? I was like, no, he seems amicable to me. They said, he's very tough. He's unforgiving. You're going to struggle. You're going to suffer. I was like, no, I'm quite enjoying this. They said, okay, we'll see how you go. Come the end of the term, it was final assessment time. We had a book called Introduction to English Literature. It was a small book, but quite dense and thorough. I learned the book by heart. I went into the exam room or the assessment, and I wrote the answers. They said, if you get anywhere over 80%, you will be a genius. I said, all right. I waited for my results. I got 82. I wasn't happy, but I wasn't sad either. I thought, okay, I think this is just my first experience. I'll do better over time. By then, I had joined what Sarah referred to as the online platform, online forum called Eye on Palestine, which Rifat created and administered for mainly students who were studying in the English language program at the IUG, but also for all students of English outside of IUG, particularly at Amid East and educational, American educational institution, or affiliated with the US government, mainly operating in third and Arab world countries. So Rifat also taught there, and there were students joining from those centers and institutions in the platform. And Rifat was running threads and posts and asking us to participate and to reflect. And I became a member. I started posting. And then he took interest in some of my reflections. He hadn't yet known that this member was me, his student in the Introduction to English Literature class. And then I wrote something and he responded to me for the first time. MG, oh my God, are you Muhammad Suleiman from my Introduction to English Literature class? And I read that and I felt ecstatic. Oh my God, he knows me. He recognizes me, because I thought that I left no impression on him. I thought he had no idea who I was when I was in his class. I got 80%, he doesn't know who I am. Actually, he knows who I am. I felt so proud. Rifat Al-Arir knows who I am. He said, I owe you 4 marks. You need to come to my office tomorrow morning. I made a mistake when I marked your paper and I gave you 82% instead of 86%. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I have 86%, not 82%. So I went to the Rifat's office the next morning and he didn't take me to his office. He took me to the cafeteria. He bought me food. He bought me drinks and he started conversing with me. He started telling me about English. We started building a friendship and he started telling me about the importance of believing in myself, in believing that I actually have potential and I could continue to write and to reflect and to study English and actually go a long way. So this was the moment. This was the turning point for me. It was all thanks to Rifat that I believe I was able to get a university education, that I was able to continue to do graduate studies and a PhD and to start writing in English. And I believe what Rifat, the impact that he left on me is exactly the impact that he left on all generations of students that later came to study under Rifat's tutelage. So what we're dealing with here is not just a teacher, like Sarah said, it's an educator, but not just an educator. He's an older brother. He's someone who truly treated you as a human being, not just as a student. He believed in his students. He tried to develop and to envision new ways that every one of us could contribute to the collective struggle and to the collective cause that is Palestine. He encouraged us to articulate ourselves. He encouraged us to write our own stories. He could see value in everything that we said, even if it was the most ridiculous thing. He would still somehow find meaning in it. He encouraged us to sit in the classroom and think. His classrooms weren't the traditional model of a lecturer standing in front of the students and dictating to them the kind of knowledge that they need to know. He would open the text, put it on the slide, on the screen, and then he would tell everyone, what do you think of the text? What do you notice about the text? And he would put you in this kind of situation where you would feel the pressure to try and articulate yourself, to try and have an opinion. He wanted every one of us to have a voice. He wanted every one of us to have a say and to be able to express themselves. So Rifat was all about language. He was about articulation. He was about how to use language as a means of self-expression. And of course, not simply individual self-expression, but also political self-expression. He knew that without being able to narrate yourself, you would cease to exist. You needed to write your own story, because to have a life is to have a story. And to be able to give life, you need to be able to tell a story. And this is what Rifat was about. He was life-giving. And because he was life-giving, he was Gaza's grand storyteller. We mentioned Yusuf. So Yusuf and I were part of the same cohort of 2007 to 2011. And we studied numerous subjects. We were actually looking for subjects that were taught by Rifat. So if we knew that a subject was traditionally taught by Rifat, and then for some reason that it wasn't taught by Rifat in one term, we wouldn't do it. We would wait until Rifat taught that subject, and then we would study it, because we just wanted to spend as much time as possible in Rifat's classes. So Rifat, Yusuf and I are currently composing a piece, and I would like to very quickly read a few things from this piece in order to try and just shed light on the life of Rifat and the impact that he had on his students and on generations of young people in Gaza. So as the specter of murder drew nearer by the day, I wish I were a freedom fighter so I could die fighting back those invading Israeli genocidal maniacs invading my neighborhood and city, wrote the prominent Palestinian academic writer and poet from Gaza, Rifat al-Arir, in one of his last posts on X. Rifat was on the front line of Palestinian social media warfare, confronting Israeli propaganda about what transpired on October the 7th and the ipso facto distortion and demonization of Palestinians in mainstream Western media in justification of Israel's war of annihilation in the besieged camp. However, in the days leading up to his martyrdom, Rifat appeared on social media only sporadically. For not only had it become onerous to get connected to the internet amid Israel's deliberate communication blackouts and devastating bombardment of Gaza and the subsequent exodus of the city's dwellers, but also when he did go online, Rifat was subjected to a vicious digital campaign of vilification on the social media platform where he had been most active and effective, and he was assailed with a heinous barrage of death threats by ardent Zionist supporters. But concurrently, within the concrete space of Gaza, Rifat had been suffering the raging inferno of Israeli firepower, pelted upon the overcrowded inhabitants of Gaza's concentration camp. Like all Palestinians in Gaza, Rifat was in imminent danger. And now, more than before, Gaza's revered academic and community leader, for this is what Rifat at bottom was, had to grapple with the growing possibility of his own murder, of his martyrdom. As he fought back against the war propaganda of the Israeli state in the digital sphere, on the ground in Gaza, Rifat was immersed in a concrete web of existence in which his most pressing concern was to survive the genocide and to procure food and water daily and single-handedly for more than 50 people sheltering in his apartment. When that had been obtained, he was not content to stay out of harm's way and be home with his family, but instead, he sought out people in need and persistently offered his help to everyone who needed it. Only one day before his murder, Rifat confided, as Ali mentioned, in his friend and companion in the genocide, Asim al-Nabih, in passing as though compelled by the need for catharsis, that he felt wearied by the sheer volume of routine chores and mundane duties that he was obligated to fulfill daily for such a large group of people during genocide. Asim admitted that he was taken aback by the rare and casual remark, for Rifat was untiring. And though he may have complained about some things, feeling tired was not one of them. In fact, Rifat seemed as though he had indulged in carrying out his duties towards others, no matter how cumbersome the tasks were. As the genocide was being perpetrated against his people, it could not have been otherwise for Rifat. He was obliged to stay behind, to remain steadfast, and be on the front lines. This was his duty toward himself. It was his duty toward the people of Gaza and toward his many students and friends who looked up to him for guidance and inspiration in the time of extreme adversity. For a long time, Rifat had grasped his role in Gaza's story and its historical struggle for humanity as that of the grand narrator and storyteller. Having arisen from the deepest strata of Gazan society, which had for long positioned itself in direct confrontation with the Israeli colonial state, he knew that defeating one's enemy with a story would be an unpropitious undertaking. For to tell a story so threatening and powerful as to precipitate the downfall of your enemy required a far greater sacrifice on his part, extending beyond the confines of the discursive and digital domains that he mainly operated within. Rifat perfectly understood that in the moment of genocide, the line between the digital and the material had been blurred and subverted. He recognized the mammoth task that lay before him, and he was unfazed by it. Rifat was endowed with profound empathy, vision, and understanding. His whole of life experience being on the receiving end of military occupation and colonial oppression meant that his premonition of danger bordered on the prophetic. He knew his enemy full well, and he knew that when the conditions had become ripe for the Israeli state to murder him, it would. And so he had to outmaneuver his enemy, to avenge his own death before it happened, and to serve justice for himself and for Gaza by himself. For Rifat is Gaza. He knew that when that moment arrived, he would be alone, and that he would have to fight alone. His rhetoric was his most lethal weapon. He had long prepared to deal his enemy a most powerful blow in the most decisive moment, the moment of his own martyrdom, by turning his death, his murder, into a catalyst for the undoing of his enemy and for its eventual defeat. The story is the victory. Rifat made sure his death would not be a mere footnote in the historical narrative of Gaza. Rifat was always going to be...
We are out of time.
...was always going to be one of the protagonists in the story of Gaza. And to be a protagonist in a digital genocide, we mean the spectacle of the genocide. Rifat had to die a spectacular death. Some would say the manner of Rifat's death was shrouded in surrealism. Others would say it was more of a certain kind of mysticism that surrounded the events of Rifat's murder. It is as if the plot had been revealed to the spectators beforehand, and the story of Rifat's martyrdom had taken place According to a pre-written script, in that moment of genocide, Rifat knew the odds of his survival had grown far too slim. In three posthumously published articles, he spoke of his intimate familiarity with death, of resignation, and outlined the five successive stages of coping with the ubiquitous loss of life and destruction of property, all the while having to care for his family and a great many others amidst the genocide. Since the destruction of Gaza had now been endorsed by Western governments and whitewashed by the Western media mega corporate apparatus, it was not a question of whether Israel would murder Rifat or not, but rather of when and how. Rifat knew that he had been identified as a target for the Israeli army. He was resigned to his fate. In a famous interview with the Electronic Intifada only these days before his assassination, and in his usual dark sense of humor, he recounted, "I am an academic. The toughest thing I have at home is an Expo marker. But if the Israelis invade, I'm going to use that marker to throw it at the Israeli soldiers, even if that is the last thing I would be able to do." After all, Rifat had no defense against F-16s, Merkavas, and artillery. Had the enemy not murdered Rifat with a bomb, it would have murdered him some other way. At any rate, Rifat needed to survive the genocide so he could continue to write his story, to enact his struggle against the occupation in the digital sphere with all the rhetorical prowess and discursive arsenal at his disposal. Rifat, however, refused to fight for his own individual survival and chose to sacrifice his life for the collective survival of Gaza, of the people, of the oppressed. This was Rifat's true sacrifice and his materiality of being. And this is the source of his legend and the most basic lesson of Rifat's life. To tell a story is to give life, and to be a storyteller is to be life-giving. Therefore, to tell one's own story is to give one's own life. Hence, if Rifat must die, let his life and his martyrdom be a tale. Rifat's story crystallized for us in the final prelude to his martyrdom, the death of the freedom fighter in the digital sphere, that is to say, the social media spectacle of the martyrdom of Gaza storyteller and digital freedom fighter, is the story of sacrifice, of life-giving, of homeland, and of heroism. In that, Rifat's life was a pure incarnation of the concept of sacrifice in all its manifold forms. Rifat embraced his humanity and declared to all humanity, "I am destiny."
Thank you.